from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Every great love story is a never-ending conversation. That's according to relationship experts Julie and John Gottman. The trick, they say, is to carve out time and to keep asking and answering good, big questions about each other. Julie Gottman joins us this Valentine's Day to talk about what it takes to stay in love long-term and about their new book, which provides a guide for when, where, and how to have these conversations. It's called 8 Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love. That's coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The new book, 8 Dates, by relationship experts Julie and John Gottman, outlines conversation-based outings designed to rekindle connection in established couples and weed out mismatches and new ones. The recommended dates include ones centered around conflict, the agree-to-disagree date, and others that focus on sex, work, and commitment. This Valentine's Day, we're going to talk with clinical psychologist Julie Gottman about her latest book and her decades of research on marriage. She is a clinical psychologist and co-author of 8 Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love, and co-founder and president of the Gottman Institute that researches and serves couples. And welcome, Julie Gottman.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. And I think the place to begin is by asking you, you had a love lab for a while, you and John Gottman, your husband. You two have to stay married, by the way, because you've become an institution, really, right?
You're so right. Sometimes we hear rumors that we're divorced. We look at each other, we say, oh dear, let's stay married, and we do.
Well, let's talk about that. But before we do, I wanted to talk with you about, you have a reputation that's extraordinary, that sounds to many like tea leaves or some kind of premonitory abilities, because the research that you've done, I think, has had a figure as high as 97% of being able to predict whether couples will stay together or not.
Well, pretty close, about 94%. So let me tell you a little bit about the lab, because, you know, people don't really understand how we could have that prediction. Shall I tell you about it a little?
Yeah, I'd like to hear.
Okay. So here's what we did. We brought in couples into a lab that looked like a living room, except that there were 4 cameras bolted to the walls, and we asked couples to please discuss an issue that they hadn't resolved. We also asked them to just discuss with each other the events of their day. How did their day go? We also measured physiology by putting a Holter monitor, which is a band across the chest that looks at heart rate. We measured how much they jiggled when they talked. And then when they were finished, we thanked them very much. They went home. We brought them back every year to 2 years for the next 20 years, and we did this with 3,000 couples. We watched the videotapes. We listened to what they said, the emotions on their faces, what their bodies did, what their heart rates did. And then we looked for patterns in the data that predicted whether they would stay together unhappily, or perhaps divorce later on. And we did this with all kinds of couples. What we found was that there were very particular patterns that predicted what these couples might end up doing 6 years down the road, to the point where we finally found, with the 15 minutes of watching them do a conflict issue, we could predict with about 94% accuracy what would happen to these couples 6 years down the road.
Well, a lot of notions about what can create longevity in a relationship have to do with love. And this is a day that, in addition to the cards and flowers and candy, supposedly has a lot to do with love. Love and intimacy seem to be the undergirding. And yet when you talk about and write about relationships, you get into so many other things, children and fidelity and religious or shared values, religious or spiritual values, those kinds of things, chores and division of labor. Where does one begin to see, in terms of predictability, just the glue of love and the glue of intimacy as really being the undergirding of all that?
Well, of course, the glue of love and intimacy is the undergirding, but the question is, how do people manifest that love? So we have all those issues out there on the table, and incidentally, we found that 69% of all problems that couples struggle with are perpetual problems. They never go away. You never solve them. So the real issues, the patterns that I'm talking about, are really about how do people talk about those issues? How do they communicate their own feelings, their own needs, maybe their own belief systems? How do they explore the other person's and listen to the other person at a much deeper level? So part of the reason that we wrote the book, Eight Dates, was that we found couples not having the conversations they needed to have, either before they made a commitment to each other, or even after decades of being together where each individual had grown a great deal, but they hadn't caught up with each other. They still were in the dark about who their partner really was and what their partner was experiencing.
And I'm glad you mentioned listening, because that is obviously of premier importance. And you say every love story is a never-ending conversation. And yet there are some people who just don't converse very well. They're reticent. They can't put their feelings into words. In fact, for the most part, in some instances, you find people who don't even like to talk about their feelings.
Yes, that's definitely true. We've seen that a lot, especially in Seattle, in the high-tech industry and so on. People are really not accustomed to talking about their feelings, and it takes vulnerability. It takes the articulation, the language to do that. So in this book, for example, what we've done is for each chapter, which is a date where they focus on a particular interesting thing about their relationship and about each other, we've given people particular open-ended questions to ask one another. First, they think about their own answers before they go on the date. Then during the date, they ask each other those questions and simply listen. And what we're encouraging people to do is to really listen with an open heart, because these are not meant to set up conflicts. That's not what this book is about. It's about, who are you now? Tell me who you are.
Who you are, as the time goes on in relationships, tends to change, doesn't it?
Absolutely. That's why it's so important to continue to have conversations like this. And Michael, I can tell you, there was a study at UCLA at the Sloan Center that was astounding. It took a sample of everyday normal couples out there and found that on average, they spoke to each other 35 minutes a week. That was it.
Yeah, that's a pretty shocking realization. And it just shows how people's lives are so involved in other things as opposed to relationships. And the old gilded notion is that you have to work on a relationship to make it work. And yet you also hear the countering argument. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, that you shouldn't have to work on a relationship. It should just be organic and shouldn't be something that requires work.
Well, I hate to disagree, but I will disagree. So, no, we do have to work on our relationships, absolutely, because people are different. They are unique individuals. There's always going to be differences between you and your partner, and conflict is inevitable. Issues that arise are inevitable. So what that means is you have to work out those issues to find your own solutions, compromises, and that has to be preceded by a deeper understanding of who your partner is, so that you can have empathy for your partner, understanding, maybe some humor, which is wonderful, and then reach compromise.
Well, you say in the book the majority of issues can't be solved and maybe aren't solved, so there's an importance of often letting go and accommodating. And you also mentioned fighting effectively. What does that mean, fighting effectively?
Well, what fighting effectively means is not fighting to destroy your partner. It's not about who's right and who's wrong. It's not a win and lose battle. So what is really important is when people bring up an issue, they need to speak what they need themselves. They describe themselves. We found in our research that there are four big predictors of divorce that have to be avoided. One is criticism, where you're really blaming a problem on a personality flaw of your partner. Another is contempt, which is even worse. That's mockery, that's sarcasm. It's putting your partner down, but from a place of superiority. Then there's defensiveness, which is the toughest one to not do. Just blaming your partner, counterattacking, or being an innocent victim. And finally, when you feel like you're facing a saber-toothed tiger, you're terrified, you go into fight or flight and shut down, which we call stonewalling, that too is another big predictor. So those need to be avoided. And in their place, what we need to do is say what you feel about what situation. You describe the situation neutrally, and then say what you need, and it's a positive need, what you do need, rather than what you do not need.
You remind me of one of the first, I guess, celebrity interviews I did. I was a young man, and I had an interview with Anne Margaret at the San Francisco Film Festival, and she had a fairly long marriage to Roger Smith, and I said, you know, what's the secret, words to that effect? And she said, we know we could push each other's buttons and we don't.
Ah, that's really wonderful. And it sounds like they knew each other well enough to know what those buttons were. And they made a very, very healthy choice, which is terrific.
What is, both you and your husband have been involved for a number of years, I think, in talking about logotherapy and Viktor Frankl. Many people mm-hmm. know Life's Search for Meaning, work of Viktor Frankl, psychiatrist. And this ties in perhaps with relationships because the sense of purpose and meaning is very important to the longevity of a relationship, values, really?
Yes. That is so very true. So, you know, what we found in looking at our 3,000 couples and also another 3,000 couples that we worked with who were in poverty all over the country, we found that no matter what anyone's IQ is, education, EQ, SQ, whatever Q you are, what we found is that everybody is a philosopher. Everybody has a deeper sense of belief, of purpose, of meaning, and when people don't have that, there's an emptiness inside. So what also these chapters do in our book, Eight Dates, is they help to open up those big questions of what are you longing for in terms of your own dreams for purpose and meaning in your life? How did your parents show there was meaning and purpose for them in their lives growing up? What do you want your life to look like now? Those kinds of questions, when couples discuss that, we have Viktor Frankl in the room nodding his head yes.
So you bring up the importance on these eight dates of going into, especially the early dates, early type relationships, past history and narratives of childhood and relationship to parents. All those things are important, integral.
Yes, you know, they really are. The reality is that, you know, what the heck is maturity? I have no idea. For that matter, health is not all that big a deal either. People who are even neurotic can have great relationships. The research shows that, which I was thrilled to hear. So what we are talking about is that people have layers to them. The earliest first years of life sit inside us at the very core of who we are, and then we build layers as we age over that initial seed. So sometimes what can happen is that if we're having a discussion that's very sensitive or painful, that early seed can get poked and prodded, and it sprouts up with very intense emotion that sometimes the individual experiencing it doesn't even understand. So we ask these questions for the dates. How did your parents do this? How did your caretakers show, for example, that there was trust between them or commitment or perhaps a lack of it? Thinking about our own history and reflecting on that helps us be more aware of our own vulnerabilities as well as helping us to understand our partner's vulnerability.
Talking with clinical psychologist Julie Gottman about relationships and what it takes to stay in love long term. And how many same-sex couples did you work with?
Well, we worked with about 300 same-sex couples. So they came from the San Francisco area as well as the Seattle area. And we followed their relationships for 12 years to see how they were doing. And it was a really fascinating study, Michael. We found some differences, but actually many things were similar.
Well, the kind of keystones that you write about to a long relationship, a long love relationship, have to do with what I've alluded to before, the things you'd expect. But you also say that adequate income and good housing are keys. And for many people, especially people who have no means or are economically in trouble or difficulties, challenges economically, and especially in places like Seattle and San Francisco, just finding housing that one can afford becomes a terrible stumbling block.
Yes, you're absolutely right. The kind of economic security that we are seeing today is a terrible, painful dilemma. And I guess, let's see, it was about 15 years ago that we participated in a national study around 2005, which created a curriculum for couples in poverty that I then trained counselors in community agencies to do all over the country. There were 3,000 couples participating in this study. And we found that those couples needed exactly the same things that we all need who are blessed enough to have money, housing, opportunities. However, we also saw that the emotional injuries, sometimes the physical injuries too, that they suffered, the stresses of poverty, made it so much more difficult for them to maintain close relationships with either a spouse or a partner or a co-parent.
Well, I know you have a sort of a specialization with distressed couples, and the distress can come certainly from economics and from social situations, as I think we've touched on here. But also, I'm wondering what advice or wisdom you have, and some of this comes through in the book, about relationships that just go stale or go south. This happens sometimes with people who are greatly in love and have tremendous passion, and then it just subsides.
You know, I think the great passion can be rekindled, Michael. That's the hope of this book. And it's why we wrote it, because we were seeing exactly the same thing. Relationships that had been together for decades with two careers, raising children together, for example, where they wouldn't talk to one another, they were too busy, not making the relationship itself a priority. So in the book, the eight dates are conversations that couples can have and actually really delight in order to reconnect with one another and to experience the joy of who their partner actually is and what that intimacy and connection, again, feels like. So stale is something that can change. It's kind of like soaking it in water, the water of good connection, of good conversation, uninterrupted conversation, and dates are a perfect way to do that.
Well, you know, I read a number of reviews of your book after reading it, and one was by a woman named Heidi Stevens, who was in the Chicago Tribune, and what she and she said good things, laudatory things about the book. But she said some of the notions of saying, you know, I'm committed to you and I will stay committed to you, and looking in the eyes and looking deeply in the eyes and all that sort of thing, deep staring with recitations that are essentially validations. She said, I know this is good advice and this would probably hold true, but it's very difficult to follow that kind of advice. And she made an interesting analogy. She said, I know that if I ate kale every day, I'd be a lot healthier than if I ate tacos, but I need tacos too.
I love that. For me, it's probably I'm never supposed to eat ice cream and chocolate, but hey, you know, where are the pleasures of life? So, yes, you know, I totally agree with her that it is very difficult sometimes to make things a priority, to make these conversations a priority. And she focused in on the affirmation that comes at the end of each chapter. And okay, well and good. You might want to do that. You might not. Maybe you don't feel quite ready to make an affirmation about commitment or about trust or about working on a particular issue. But the most important thing that I think she also mentioned is that these conversations are the meat of the book. How to have conversations, what questions to ask each other that can open up the heart of your partner and that give you pause for reflection so that you can increase your awareness in yourself, increase awareness of your partner. Then, okay, you want to make that affirmation at the end of each chapter or the end of each date, fine, well and good, but you don't have to. And incidentally, tacos are delicious.
Isn't it also true, Dr. Gottman, that sometimes whether your partner is same sex or different sex, you're talking a different language much of the time, aren't you?
Well, you are, and yet you're not. You know, we all speak the same, more or less, the same language. But then again, we also have great differences. And what we've actually found in the research, not John and I, but other folks, is that they couples who are really drawn to one another and end up together are often very different from each other. So what they need to do is create their own culture. Every relationship, whether it's gay, it's straight, it's transgender, wherever it is, you're creating a culture within the relationship itself. And in our chapter on family, one of the things that we talk about is family can mean many things. Family, for example, can mean extended family, it can mean children or not, it can mean community, the most important people in the community that feel like a chosen family for you. So each partner in that chapter is discussing, so what does family mean to you?
No, finish your sentence. There was a pause there.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, how was the notion of family treated as you were growing up? Yeah. What was your experience of what family meant growing up? And how do you want to create a family in this relationship if you're ready to do that here and now? That chapter is a very important one.
Well, we're talking with the co-author of a book called Eight Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love, Julie Schwartz-Gottman. And you can join the program. In fact, we would like to hear your thoughts or any questions you might have. And you can give us a call now as we continue on Valentine's Day to talk about what we talk about when we talk about love. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. That's, again, 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, and you can email any questions or comments you have to forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with clinical psychologist Julie Gottman about relationships and what it takes to stay in love long term. And we want to hear from you. How do you stay connected with your partner? You can give us a call now at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And I should mention that this book was done in conjunction with Doug Abrams and Rachel Carlin Abrams. Doug Abrams has been on the Forum program in the past, and you can be on the Forum program now, this hour, if you have questions or comments for our guest, Julie Gottman. Love is a very many-splendored thing, but it is, as William says, something that, well, let me read this comment to you, Julie Gottman. He says, is there any recognition by your guests that relationships can run their course? happiness can be found with different partner or different partners.
Okay. So happiness can be found with different partners?
Well, meaning... if you look online these days, dating online things, you see people describing themselves as being, let's say, what's the word they use? It essentially means they're polygamous.
Yeah, polyamorous.
Polyamorous, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, some people can find happiness in polyamorous families or polyamorous connections. There's quite a big community of folks who are polyamorous in Seattle as well. And, you know, I think the jury is that we don't really know yet whether polyamorous relationships can be successful in the long term. You know, I think these folks are pioneers. They're working hard at it. They have to balance a lot of kind of typical instinctive human emotions that have to do with insecurity or perhaps jealousy. But they also are really working hard to be skillful at communicating what they're feeling and what they're needing, as I understand it. And so who knows? Perhaps those relationships can work as well.
What would you say, though, about, and we'll hear from, I'm sure, some listeners on this, there's so much availability now on the Internet in terms of one date after another. You're talking about 8 dates, but over an extended period of time. Sometimes that first date can be make or break, and sometimes people are on their best behavior the first date and can present themselves very well and masquerade, and sometimes the first date can go to hell, whereas if there were more dates, it could have been maybe possible. Something could have been intimate.
Yes, you know, you are absolutely right. All of us have that insecurity inside where we're terrified we're going to be rejected. And so that first date, we are on our best behavior. You know, we try on 18 different sets of clothing to make sure we're dressed just right and so on. So this book is not necessarily for the very, very first date, but maybe the third date. That's where it can start with new couples, where at least you know there's an attraction, which is important. There's some sparks. There's interest. This person hasn't turned you off. You're curious about them. You want to know more about them. And the dates give you a roadmap for how to learn more about that individual.
So forgive me, is chemistry initially the most important criterion, you would say?
The most important criteria
initially
for a long-lasting relationship?
No, I'm talking about initially, when people just meet for the first time.
Well, it's certainly important. I wouldn't say that it's completely, you know, secondary, depending on who you are. If you're asexual, if you're not looking for a relationship that's going to have physical passion in it, and you're meeting up with somebody who's not interested in that either, then that's fine. But if sexuality is something that's important to you, then, yeah, chemistry is important in that first date. And it's typically what we kind of gravitate towards as we're sitting across from that person.
And Gary, I was just going to say, Gary, one of our listeners wants to know if chemistry is a reliable predictor of longevity in relationships.
Absolutely not. It has nothing to do with longevity. Isn't that interesting?
Isn't maybe the most important thing to longevity values, similar values, shared values?
Nope. It's not that either.
So tell me, what is it?
Okay, the most important predictor of longevity actually is, can you make repairs after a conversation has gone south? And I'll tell you why that matters. Because over time, couples have disagreements, they have differences, they have to work those out in order to have a long-lasting relationship. And inevitably, they're going to do one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse, as we call them. They may get critical at one point or defensive, maybe even a little contemptuous, or maybe they get triggered and shut down. How do they make a repair afterwards? Can they make a repair early enough to prevent greater emotional damage? It's that repair process that we found very important in terms of longevity.
And what about these couples? They may be very few in number, I suspect they are, but they're just lovey-dovey all the time. They're totally dedicated, committed, not just on the surface for show, but there's no argument, there's no perturbations, there's like nothing that rises between them.
Well, you know, those probably are couples who are conflict avoiders. We have three sets of couples that we discovered in our research. There are those who are volatile in terms of dealing with conflict, very passionate, very intense, very honest and direct. There are people who are what we call validators, who are more calm, rational. They'll express some feelings, but it's mostly problem solving and rationality. And then there are folks who just agree to disagree, and they put it under the carpet, and they go on. And folks like that can have successful relationships, too. However, they have to be careful, because life is always delivering something that you don't expect. And those relationships tend to be a little bit more brittle in terms of their ability to withstand the vagaries of life that can hit them.
Now, there's this whole phenomenon of gunny sacking, too. People keep those things inside, and then they come out later in different ways. But just a reminder that Julie Schwartz-Gottman is our guest, and she's a clinical psychologist and co-author of 8 Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love. Let me go to our calls. And Lisa, let's begin with you. Good morning.
Yes, hi, good morning. I had a question about people who grew up in very traumatic childhoods, and whether it really is possible to heal from that, repair from that, and enter into an adult relationship. I'm beginning to doubt it is. I wanted to know if it really is, if it really is possible.
I'm sorry, Lisa, but what's the reason for your doubt, if you could say?
I think it's when you come from that kind of background, I'm not, even if you've done a lot of work on yourself, I don't know that you have the ability to pick a good partner in the first place, someone who doesn't trigger all of those childhood traumas that you need to somehow replay and repair.
You mean it continues to haunt, I think is what you're
correct.
Saying. Yeah.
Correct. In choices of new partners, in choices of a partner.
Julie Gottman, some thoughts for you?
Yes. You know, Lisa, I completely empathize with you. childhood trauma is one of the specialties that I treat and have for the last 40 years. And here's what I've seen. You actually can have a successful relationship even with severe childhood trauma, things like incest, physical abuse, outside sexual abuse, mental abuse, even torture. You still can have a successful relationship. The thing that is the most difficult is building trust. And so the important thing to do is to find a partner who seems kind, who seems curious about you. You don't tell them all about your trauma right up front, but fairly soon after you've seen some markers that they're trustworthy, things like they call when they say they're going to call, they show up when they say they're going to show up. So you very, very, very quietly begin to introduce to them some of the stuff you grew up with. Now, does that scare them? If it scares them and they run away, okay, well and good. They're not the partner for you. But if they still feel compassion for you, they're there, they want to listen, maybe they ask you some questions about it, they look like they're really feeling something in response to you, those are all good signs. I have seen relationships with some of the most severe traumatized individuals, and they can be even deeper and more meaningful. So I encourage you to have hope, but trust very gradually and slowly.
Lisa, she's telling you to have hope. There is okay. Is there a read there, a read of hope for you in that?
There is. I mean, I think the biggest thing is it was very helpful to hear your description of what to look for, because I think that's the piece that's most difficult, is because that was not modeled in my childhood. It's hard to know what to look for, and so I think your description of those specific things to look for.
I'm glad you got some sense of a help, and onward and upward, Lisa. Thank you for the call. Good to hear from you, and we'll hear from another caller, and that's Jeremy joining us from Emeryville. Jeremy, welcome.
Hello, and thank you both. Great answers, great discussion. I was just more commenting, getting feedback on. Well, I'm in my 40s. A pretty deep love I've found, and I'm happy about it because I began to give up a little. But just the little things seem to show the most to me about taking care of each other, helping each other with each other's goals, like helping my girlfriend get to work on time after a frustrating day where her phone didn't charge, and today waking her up gently and starting her tea and so forth. And it's a reciprocation that's sometimes surprisingly harmonious, and it just feels so right. And yes, it's got bumps. God, it's got bumps. But talking through them, as you said, seems to be how you repair it seems to be the best, and how you show it seems to be the little things.
I think, Jeremy, you've hit on something that's quite important, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, Julie Gottman. I mean, you know, it's an old cliche, but the little things can matter and do matter.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, we found that in our research, Jeremy, and it sounds like you are doing all the right stuff. So we had couples in an apartment lab who were there for 24 hours, and we found that the most successful couples, the ones who lasted for a lifetime, were couples who turned towards each other in little ways. They would do small things often for their partner. They would make them coffee. They might get up and turn off the TV if their partner didn't like the TV show they were watching. They would ask their partner, how was your day, at the end of the day? And they would actually really listen to the answers. So that notion of turning toward is one of the big seven principles that make a relationship successful. So congratulations, Jeremy. You're doing great.
And thank you for the call, Jeremy. And speaking of seven principles, a listener writes, I love your books and your seminar. We've read the seven principles for making marriage work, and we have the accompanying open-ended cards. How is this new book different? The question every author loves. Julie Gottman.
Well, that's a good one. All right. So this book is different in that the open-ended questions are very helpful. Those are questions that couples can ask each other to just check in with each other. But this book really focuses more on the deeper questions, the ones that go really way down into the heart and are topic-oriented. For example, things like sex and intimacy. What is it that you really like sexually? What kind of touch do you like? When do you like to make love? Where do you like to make love? How can I maybe refuse making love in a moment if I'm not feeling like it without crushing your soul? So the questions that couples address in these chapters are more topic-focused. They talk about trust, what trust looks like to you, what commitment looks like to you, what your notion of family is, and also in fun and adventure, which is a great chapter, how do you like to play? And there's lots of wonderful questions to talk about with how do you like to have adventures versus wanting to sit at home and sit in front of the fireplace? What does adventure look like for you? Can I give you a great example?
Love to hear a great example of adventure. You bet.
Okay, so here's a good one. So John and I are completely different when it comes to our sense of adventure. So when we address that question, John's answer is, you know, my great sense of adventure is sitting in my red chair reading physics and looking at derivative equations. And my eyes cross. My great sense of adventure, on the other hand, is going mountain climbing in Nepal, going up to Mount Everest. So, okay, he gets altitude sick on a ladder. How are we going to create a sense of adventure together? So we have to explore that question in all kinds of nuances, and we hit upon, we both love the sea, we both love to kayak, it's outdoors, but you're still sitting, even though you're sitting in a moving object, and you can have a wonderful time. So we have that for our sense of adventure and try to practice that as often as we can.
Do you hear? I thought you were going to say you go to Nepal together. He sits at the foot of the mountain reading and you go climb.
Not a chance.
Well, here's a listener who writes, my husband and I talk regularly, and one thing I've learned is to process my feelings before I talk to him. He's always helpful when I know what I need or when I don't and ask him to share his observations. I believe in the ease of a relationship. Yes, it's work, but it's joyful work. And Pete says there's nothing like the five A's, attention, acceptance, appreciation, affection, and allowing. And we'll allow some more phone calls. We'll go next to Albany and welcome Elizabeth. Good morning.
Good morning. Earlier in your conversation, you mentioned the difficulty of having relationships when you're in poverty. And I'm someone who's ready to date and emotionally ready for in-depth experience, but I'm very poor. I live on food stamps, and that inequality is something I don't know how to bring to a new relationship.
Any advice for her, Julie Gottman?
Oh, gosh, I feel for you. You know, I think there has to be careful judgment for you in terms of, is this person that you are going out with non-judgmental about your state economically? Some people are going to judge you. Some people are not. Some people are going to value your sense of humor, your intelligence, your kindness, your good heart, your wish to participate in the world, and that will be the most important things to them. That's what they will be looking for. So it's a matter of asking them, when you first date, asking them a question like, so what do you think are the most important characteristics of somebody you're looking for? And if they say economic success, okay, you know where they stand, and that's not the person for you. If they say other characteristics that have more to do with what kind of human being are you, then there's a good sign. So don't be afraid. You are worthy of a relationship, and you can have a good relationship with somebody who has no judgments around how much money is sitting in a bank account somewhere.
Yeah, we wish you good luck, Elizabeth. Thank you for that call. Here's a listener who says, attraction and excitement can be very dangerous because we can get excited by very bad qualities. I think it's a terrible basis for a relationship. Respect, however, lasts a long time and enables one to work through differences without damaging each other. Pretty much agree with that, Julie Schwartz-Gottman?
We can be attracted to bad qualities, and the key there is really being aware of yourself. You know, for example, if you grew up in a family where you had, let's say, a father who was extremely domineering and bullying, and then as an adult you find yourself gravitating towards those guys who were domineering and bullying, yet you can remember, uh-oh, there's that red flag. There's my father again. There he is. I don't want any part of that. So the wonderful thing to do is to practice your own awareness of those negative qualities that you may be drawn to and begin to substitute the thoughts about, ooh, God, aren't they hot, with red flag, red flag, and quick, back away.
Sasha, let's go to you next. Quick question for Julie Gottman.
Just wanted to thank you for being so thorough about covering poly relationships and asexual individuals. And then I wanted to ask you about whether your 8 dates covers or it's relevant for couples that have been in long-term relationships. I've been in a 30-year-plus relationship. And I can take
you know,
off the air.
Yes. It is absolutely for those relationships, in fact. That's part of why we wrote it. We were seeing a lot of couples who'd been together for decades who had forgotten how to have these conversations, had gone through decades of change, of growth, of evolution, but they really didn't connect with one another as they were doing so. So I highly recommend this book for couples like that. Those are the folks who really can benefit from the book, having these conversations and rekindling your curiosity about one another and the love that may be there, but it's deep down under the surface.
All right. I want to thank Sasha for the call. Excuse me, Julie, but we've got a break here, and I want to remind our listeners that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio, and for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. We'll go to another caller next. James, thanks for waiting. Join us from Oakland. You're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for having me. I and my present partner, we're both out of 20-year-plus relationships. We've been divorced several years. My interest is something the author spoke about something earlier about speaking the same language. In our case, we speak the same language, except that hers is her second language. She's an immigrant from South Asia, and she's also coming out of an arranged marriage. And so her perspective on marriage is quite different than my own. And I wondered if the author had any experience with these kind of bicultural relationships and any advice for those in them. And I think it's changed, particularly people in the Bay Area. This seems to be the norm.
Yeah, thank you for that question, James. I'd be curious to know what you have to say on that, Julie Gottman.
Yes. So, James, in Seattle, there are many, many inter-ethnic, interracial, and intercultural relationships. So we have lots of experience with those, as do I individually. And so what is very, very important is, again, even more important, is asking your partner questions that have to do with their culture. So if your partner is really wanting something in particular or needing a change of some kind, asking that person things like, so, you know, tell me what this was like for you growing up. What was this like in your country? How was this dealt with in your country? Did those values have meaning to you? And how can I honor those values that are in your core, in your soul, that are so important to you? How can I honor those? And how can I support you in integrating your own culture, your own needs having to do with that culture, into our relationship? So keep asking those questions having to do with how that individual grew up and what they experienced in their culture. Because no matter how much we think we can understand another person, especially one from a different culture, you know, we're only scratching the surface. We know very little. So we have to keep asking every time it looks like there's a cultural issue hovering between you so that you can unpack it and understand it.
And let me thank James for the call. So much seems to come back to conversations and communicating. And again, I get back to the fact that when you have language barriers or when you have people who are not as well-spoken or as able to be fluent, you certainly have difficulties to break through.
Yes, you're absolutely right, Michael. You do have difficulties, but you know, every couple has difficulties. Every couple is different in terms of each partner being different from the other, having a different point of view. That person is in a different brain and body from you. different experiences. So that's why conversation is so crucial and why the conversations in this book can also be so helpful.
And the book, again, is 8 Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love. And here's a caller, Sammy, who I think you've been married 60 years, Sammy, huh?
Right. Yeah. And I was telling the gal who answered that we have this book that has 4,000 conversation starters. And the other night, the electricity went off, and I said, you know, let's have some fun. So I grabbed the book, and I just turned to a page, and I asked Raj one of the questions. And the conversation went on from 8 o'clock till midnight. And we just have so much fun. You know, it's we're two totally different people, been married 60 years, and nobody gave us any hope to be married for 1 month. And Raj was a Marine, and I was totally, you know, this foo-foo. My father was a diplomat. And so we come from two totally different places. But, you know, there's, if you converse with each other, and Raj is not a great conversationalist, but if you ask him a question and you ask the right one, he'll go on for hours.
And you got 4,000 to ask. You can go another 60 years easily. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Yes. We got enough for.
Well, congratulations on that, on reaching that extraordinary benchmark, and I thank you for the call. And Julie Schwartz-Gottman, I thank you for this hour. And again, the book that she and her husband have done, John Gottman, is called 8 Dates, Essential Conversations for a Lifetime of Love. Good to have you with us, Julie. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's really been a pleasure.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion online by going to kqed.org. And this program is live now. We'll be back. Well, Mina will be with you tomorrow from 9 to 11 live, and we'll be back on Monday with the program that we recorded. It's a must hear if you weren't there. It was at the Big City of Lights, Night of Ideas at the San Francisco Main Library. Stay tuned for more here on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.